I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Jackson County's November ballot is packed with issues. Among them, a request to raise the levy for the Kansas City Public Library and a series of Jackson County charter changes. We'll unpack those for you today and see what the impact could be if voters approve more money for libraries and more restrictions on the county legislature and executive. Later, several cities in Johnson County, Kansas, seem set to jump on a non-discrimination ordinance bandwagon aimed at protecting members of the LGBTQ community. We'll ask why backers think the laws are needed and find out why others see it as a threat to religious liberty. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The leaders of the Kansas City Public Library are asking voters for a tax boost for library services and what would be the first levy increase for the library in 22 years. It would raise the owner of a $150,000 house about $23 a year. Much of the money would go for major renovations to the Waldo branch and the Northeast branch, and it would allow the library to offer a refugee and immigrant services program at the Northeast branch, where there's a growing population of new immigrants. There's no organized opposition. Joining us now to talk about this proposal is Crosby Kemper. He's executive director of the Kansas City Public Library. Crosby, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
Why is this so important to the library?
Well, our revenue essentially got capped in 2007 as the city developed its property tax abatement and diversion programs to support economic development. And money goes from the library and school district, mental health levy, et cetera, into those projects. So, and we have 25-year-old facilities like Northeast and Waldo, which you mentioned, that we're going to be updating all of our facilities, which are including Trails West and our Southeast and Bluford libraries. But we also need the money because we have growing technology needs. We have 800,000 computer sessions every year, helping the 25% of our population that doesn't have access to the internet, the 70% of the kids in the school district and similar number in charters who don't have access at home. And we have growing needs for children's literacy, where we're working with the school district and the charters to do literacy centers. And we have an aging population where we're doing homebound book delivery and other materials. We're streaming movies and music and of course books. We're downloading books off the internet to homebound folks and then providing the internet to folks who don't have it.
You know, I've read that at the Waldo branch, some repairs have gone so long neglected that you actually have rainwater coming in during rainstorms.
We didn't plan it, but we did a press conference to announce our vote for your library committee. And during the press conference, it started raining, and it rained inside the library. The Waldo library is actually sinking, and we designed all those 1990s libraries with skylights. Unfortunately, before my time, if I'd been there, I would have told them from my bank experience, don't do that, and they all leak. And so we need to do – Waldo probably is the library that needs the most in terms of basic infrastructure renovation.
If you don't get the increase, what does that mean for the future of the system?
Well, we have very good hours right now, and we provide a lot of technology services, and we have a great book collection. All those things will be under siege, under attack, if we don't, because our revenue's growing at less than 1% a year. Inflation's growing at 2.5% a year now, and it means we're losing money every year on an inflation-adjusted basis. So we'd have to do something about that, and then particularly the facilities. We have not renovated any of these facilities during their lives, and they need it desperately: roofs and HVAC, parking lots, bathrooms. We need all of that. And they won't get it.
Let's walk through some of the basics of this tax, Crosby. How much of an increase are you asking for? Give us the details here.
So it's 8 cents on $100 of property tax valuation, a little bit less than 1% increase in your property tax is what will happen. It's $2.8 million a year to us, which is roughly speaking, is probably a little bit less, but roughly speaking, the amount of money that the city diverts through TIF and tax abatement. And as you pointed out, it's a relatively small increase. If you have a $100,000 house, it's about $1.20 a month, a candy bar a month, if you will. So we deliberately kept it as low as we could to replace the money that we lost, because we recognize that people on fixed incomes, this is, you know, any property tax increase is a problem. One thing I like to point out is that this tax will be paid by some people. It is a progressive tax. It'll be paid by some people, particularly some commercial entities that are TIFed or TIFed today who aren't paying property tax. They will actually pay this tax.
Oh, really? There's an exception
so
to that.
So just as an example, that you know, we all were in favor of giving breaks to H&R Block for them to move their world headquarters to downtown to help renovate downtown, but they haven't paid property tax, and they will pay this tax, just as an example, not to attack H&R Block, but just it is a progressive tax.
Well, why did you go the property tax route? Why not try the sales tax?
We're not allowed to do a sales tax. Hmm. We have no other way of raising money under Missouri state law other than the property tax and raising money from private sources, which we've done a lot of in recent years. The renovations, the Central Library and the Plaza Library, the creation of the Plaza Library have a lot of private money in them. But to renovate the branches, we needed to do that with public money.
Crosby Kemper, the executive director of the Kansas City Public Library, is my guest. Tell us about the Refugee and the Immigrant Services Program at the Northeast Branch, Crosby, that you'd like to implement here. What do you have in mind?
Well, you know, I spoke to the Northeast Chamber of Commerce earlier this week, and I told them, which they, of course, already knew, Independence Avenue, your next guest, Jeff Fox, knows this too. Independence Avenue is one of the great success stories in Kansas City, and it's an immigrant neighborhood. We have materials in dozens of languages over there. We have immigrants from the Balkans, from Vietnam, from Africa, from South America and Central America, and it's a dynamic neighborhood. But there are a lot of specific needs that relate to language and relate to culture. So we've created an immigrant services program, one of the few libraries in the country, though it's a growing thing happening in libraries, and we're doing naturalization ceremonies in the library. You know, we have a lot of, we're going to do
always
one,
a cool thing to
yeah,
see.
Yeah, we're going to do one in about a month, and we have 100, 120 people coming from 50, 60, 70 countries becoming citizens of the United States. It's a moving ceremony to see these folks who've worked very hard to become citizens of this country.
Final point, the library levy funds roughly what percentage of your operating budget? What are you looking at here?
So this will end up being an increase in our operating budget of a little over 10%. And it's a very important 10% because it'll keep us open hours. We may actually be able to increase our hours in certain areas when we're going to look at that based on need. And it will allow us to continue these literacy services and computer services, which are really, really important for kids and really important for people trying to get into the job market, get healthcare information, et cetera.
That's Crosby Kemper. He's executive director of the Kansas City Public Library, talking about the proposed boost in library taxes coming up on the ballot in November. Crosby, always appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, another series of questions on the November ballot concerns Jackson County voters who will be calling for big changes in the way the county is run and by whom. A series of separate questions would set term limits on elected officials and shift some of the county executive's powers to the legislature, among other things. Joining me now to run down these questions is Jeff Fox. He's the editor of The Examiner, serving eastern Jackson County. Jeff, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, what's spurring this sweeping set of proposals that would go so far toward a major change in the way Jackson County does business? Why are we having this conversation?
Well, a couple of legislators are going off the legislature this year. Some of them have been there for a long time. Greg Grounds is one of them. He's a Republican from Blue Springs. He has been pushing this conversation forward for close to a year now. A lot of different ideas were out there. Do we want to shrink the size of the legislature? That went away. But do we want to look at other things? Term limits, is pay what it ought to be, that kind of thing. And then, of course, the legislature and the executive have been going back and forth over any number of issues, one of which is the jail. Lots of other counties, most counties in America, have their jails under the sheriff. Most people are surprised to find that's not the case here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things that's on the ballot. But you've got seven individual questions, but many, many changes within those questions.
How much of all this is driven by this level of discord between the legislature and County Executive Frank White?
Well, that'd be speculation, but certainly it seems reasonable that some of it is. I mean, they've gone back and forth a little bit over. They have to approve department directors, but not interim directors. So, you know, you can play a game there. So they want to tighten that up. They've sued over combat,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it was in the prosecutor's office years ago. They brought it in the executive's office. Now the legislature wanted to give it back to the prosecutor. Okay, so that's another one that's in there as well. Mm-hmm. So it's they've gone back and forth on any number of issues.
You can't help but wonder, we're going to talk about the specifics in just a couple of minutes here, but as you go through these issues, if all this were to pass, you wonder what authority would be left for the county executive and what the point of having a county executive would even be.
I think that's a point that a lot of critics have brought up, or a lot of people just are not good with this, or maybe they are good with it, I don't know. It would significantly reduce the role of the Jackson County executive. They wouldn't have a jail, wouldn't have combat, and would have, well, he'd have a lot less authority over the budget, because as it stands now, the executive proposes a budget about this time of year. It's, what are we coming up on Thanksgiving? It'll be coming soon. The legislature approves it, makes changes, doesn't make changes, and then it's in his hands. And he has to balance income and outgo, so he has that day-to-day responsibility throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, control of the budget from then on rests with him. But they have gone back and forth on that, and this would shift a lot of that power over to the legislature.
I'm visiting with Jeff Fox from The Examiner about a series of questions on the ballot in November for Jackson County voters that would affect the operations of the legislature and the county executive. Let's run through these, Jeff, one by one here. Question one does several things involving pay raises, term limits, and giving the legislature new authority. Tell us about question one.
So the overall piece, before I dive into that, is that even though these are issues that cut across these questions, the questions themselves are structured. This is the executive, this is the legislature, this is the prosecutor. So it ends up being, if you want A, you've got to have B. Like in on the one on the legislature, if you want term limits for legislators, which is very popular, you're also approving a pay increase, which mm-hmm. is probably not very popular.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, and then there's the bit on approving interim and acting directors, that kind of thing, and the ability to the budget thing I talked about, the ability
right.
to override whatever cuts the executive or changes the executive might want to have made.
And just to be clear here, we're cutting the responsibilities of the executive at the same time we're giving the executive position a pay increase.
That's correct.
How much of a pay increase would the executive get? How much of an increase would the legislators get here, Jeff?
Legislators are getting, and they're in the 34,000 range, I think, now.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go to about 40. Yeah, they're 34.8 now, and they would go to 49,000. And the executive would go from 145 to 158.
Okay.
So those are tied, those figures are tied to salaries that are given to judges in some case.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how they arrived at that formula, but that's how they want to go.
And just to point out to our listeners, as a good editor does, Jeff just grabbed a copy of his own newspaper to look up the numbers here. I don't blame you a bit.
It's in great detail in today's Examiner. There's my plug.
Question two would restrict the county executive's ability to hire consultants without legislative approval. Why do lawmakers want to do that?
Well, they've gone back and forth on how appropriate that is about spending money that they want to have more control over. That's on any number of issues.
Mm-hmm.
The executive has hired a good deal of outside legal assistance because the legislature and the executive are in court
mm-hmm.
over various disputes. So then that bill keeps going up.
Question three, the authority for running the jail, as you've mentioned, would shift from the county executive to the sheriff. I'm wondering what the thinking is there, and you've already pointed out that lots of sheriffs around the country tend to run their jails.
And, yeah, it seems to be more in the bailiwick of sheriffs, right? The other piece is that you would presumably have more sworn officers, that is to say sheriff's deputies, inside the jail. The thought on that is that would be an improvement in safety, an improvement in professionalism, all that sort of thing. But you pay them more. I mean, the county has struggled with this issue for some time now about the low pay of corrections officers. They've addressed that to try to cut down on the huge turnover they've had and,
right.
you know, and staffing issues, just keeping the place staffed.
Yeah.
So if you do that, that's fine. But it bears a cost. And I was talking to Tony Miller, one of the legislators who opposes this, and his point was, I'm good with that idea, generally speaking, I think. Let's have that conversation. But we also need to know what that cost is, and we don't.
And I should point out that this is the way the county used to do it. The sheriff used to run the jail back in the day, back in the 70s, I think.
I think there was an issue with the sheriff having some troubles with the jail, and that was a reform back at the time.
Okay. Yeah. So. Question four would shift control of the combat anti-drug program away from the executive. Right. It would go where, Jeff?
It would go to the prosecutor. It's actually already with the prosecutor. That's a change that the legislature made last year. This would just write it into the charter. And if, again, County Executive Frank White Jr. opposed that. They went to court over that, but that's where we are now.
In question five, voters would be asked to give the legislature the power to appoint and remove the county's top legal advisor, known as the county counselor. That person is now appointed by the county executive. Again, why is the legislature thinking that's a good idea?
You know, it's kind of a complicated question, or at least a touchy question that I think people on both sides of this field need to work it out. The county counselor's office works for the whole county. Doesn't work for the executive, doesn't work for the legislature. It just represents the interests of the county. And the current county counselor is very emphatic on that point. That said, legislators don't always see it shaking out that way, so they want to have a little more say over that. Because that person does work at the pleasure of the executive.
Question six, Jeff, would require that the chief judge would have to have at least 3 years of experience as a judge hearing cases in the county court. Currently, all that's required is a law license and county residency.
Yeah, there's really just one change there. I'm not hearing a whole lot of controversy on this. The change is you would have to have been a municipal court judge in this county for at least 3 years.
And finally, and thank goodness there's a finally here, question seven would bar a current holder of any other federal, state, or municipal elective office from filing as a candidate for any county elective position. What's that about?
That's kind of a head-scratcher. The stated reason is that it does address what many people would view as a problem, which is the power of incumbency in running for other offices.
Mm-hmm.
So the stated reason is if you're going to be about Jackson County, you need to be about Jackson County, not hopping from a state legislative position, let's say, into this. So there you are.
This is a whole lot for voters
to
consider.
It's a lot of stuff.
Is there a lot of confusion out there, do you think?
I think there is. And, you know, we had Jackson County Election Board folks on a Facebook Live at the paper a couple of weeks ago, and I think the point that jumped out at me from that was they're really urging people to go online, look at the ballot, and know what's out there. Because the ballot, when you walk in this year in Eastern Jackson County, is 8.5 by 17-inch piece of paper, both sides.
Wow.
Okay?
Wow.
Because, well, think of all the things that are on the ballot. You've got a Senate race. You've got other legislative
right.
races. You've got marijuana times three, minimum wage, gas tax. Then you flip the thing over to this page two, and you see these seven questions along with other things. So there is a question of, are people just going to look at this and kind of throw up their hands?
Well, and you do wonder about the length of the lines come election day. I mean, we don't have advanced voting in Missouri, and we may be paying the price for that this year with this ballot that's long, it's complicated, and there's a lot of interest in this election.
What the election folks were telling us is you know, get, you know, do your homework on this. Know the ballot before you walk in there, because they were seeing people taking 20 minutes to vote as absentees, even if they had kind of, you know, read ahead. And if they didn't, it was taking 30, 40 minutes. So, yeah. Okay. Election day, get there early.
So why did county officials spread these questions out over 7 different ballot items? Why not put them under just one umbrella? We're changing government here.
Right.
One question.
It's several dozen changes boiled down to 7 questions. You could get to one. I asked Greg Grounds, the legislator I mentioned earlier, about that, and he's kind of wrestled with this all year long. His attempt was to make it manageable. You know, and that's fine, because if you have even just one deeply unpopular thing in one question, it might kill all of it.
Right. So. Well, the county executive, Frank White, he can't be very happy about this. He's losing all kinds of authority if these issues wind up passing.
He vetoed this, and they overrode his veto to proceed and get this on the ballot.
What else has he said about it?
Well, he put out a veto message that, you know, took issue with it. One of the things that he argued then, and I wrote about at the time, I didn't get into it in today's story, is that he argues that there's a loophole in term limits, because it says it's consecutive terms. And in theory, Steve Kraske could be a 2-term legislator, could go ahead and file for a 3rd term and get on the ballot, and he's the greatest guy in the world, so he wins that 3rd term, and all he has to do is get to December 10th and quit and not be a legislator for a couple of weeks, and then here we go again.
Right.
Now, that sounds like a pretty theoretical loophole. Is that going to happen? I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah.
What are hijinks possible in Jackson County politics?
Well, that's Jeff Fox giving us a rundown on the Jackson County proposed charter changes on the ballot coming up here. Jeff is editor of the Examiner, serving Eastern Jackson County. Jeff, it's always great to have you here. Thanks for the good rundown. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
When we come back, we're going to talk about Northeast Johnson County, which is passing LGBTQ regulations right and left, opening the doors and offering more protection to people who go there, and that's on the very much coming up as a hot issue in Northeast Johnson County. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we met Chris Harris. He's worked for decades to bring golf to the inner city, and very soon he'll be ready to open his own golf course in his Eastside Ivanhoe neighborhood. You can hear that conversation and other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we'll meet the new fire chief of Wyandotte County in KCK, and we'll ask how he's dealing with the issues that came with the job, including staffing, overtime, and even station closing. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the trend in Northeast Johnson County is clear. Cities are adopting ordinances aimed at protecting gay and transgender individuals from discrimination. Merriam just took a big step in that direction on Monday. That city follows Prairie Village and Mission, which already have taken action, and a councilman now in the Overland Park City Council has expressed interest in this idea as well. One reason for the push, the state of Kansas has refused to extend protections. Here to tell us more about this are Brent Hodel. He's chair of the Metro KC chapter of Equality Kansas. Brett, nice to have you. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Sally Flora is the Ward 4 city councilor for the city of Mission. Sally, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you.
The trend here is unmistakable, Brett. Why is this happening?
Well, I think when you... If you look at the protections nationwide, there are no protections for LGBTQ individuals in the law, either at the federal level or at the state of Kansas. And we're actually seeing some hostility towards these individuals in some of the actions taken by the Trump administration. I believe that's leading members in these communities to take these to their local cities to say, you know, since we're not being protected by the feds, we're not being protected by the state, we want our local communities to protect our friends and neighbors.
I was going to say the state hasn't exactly pitched in to help out, right?
No, and they've signed on to court cases as recently as this, I think, past summer, advocating for the stance that you should be able to be fired for being transgender.
Sally, what exactly is a non-discrimination ordinance?
Yeah, so a non-discrimination ordinance would be to fill the gap that Brett's been talking about in state and federal law. So basically, it would provide uniform legal protections for different categories, including, as we're here to discuss, I think, primarily today, LGBT protections. But it would also provide for city-level non-discrimination measures for, you know, race, sex, veteran status, some other statuses that are already protected under state and federal law, just to make one uniform protection. And so the idea would be that you cannot be discriminated in housing, in your employment, or in public accommodations under the basis of LGBT status and these other protected categories.
You know, do these ordinances pretty much do the same thing that the state of Kansas would have done if it had passed a law like this?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's going to be some variation in the enforcement mechanisms, and even different cities have done it differently. But that's the idea, is you could take the Kansas Act Against Discrimination and add these categories there. But since the state has shown a failure to act, cities are filling that gap.
And these ordinances are needed. Why, in your estimation?
Well, I think first and foremost, as Brett alluded to, because constituents are asking for them. And so in particular, Brett mentioned some of the recent hostility. I started hearing from some of my residents after the state passed the Adoption Discrimination Act last spring.
And that prohibited certain individuals from being able to adopt, right?
Right. It allowed agencies receiving state funds to discriminate on that basis in foster care and adoption. And so that, combined with Wyandotte County taking this issue under advisement, they actually passed a non-discrimination ordinance this spring. So I heard from constituents with both of those things sort of acting as an impetus, I think, as to why our city should be looking at this issue.
Brett, I'm wondering, what kinds of groups have traditionally been covered by these ordinances that are being passed now by cities around Northeast Johnson County?
As far as, I guess, are you asking if in the non-discrimination ordinances typically cover,
right,
you know, race,
right,
religion, and veteran status? There are already federal protections for those type of those classes, and this, again, most states have their own protections as well. We're just trying to fill that gap,
yeah,
in those protections.
Just quickly, Sally, what other cities in the metro have adopted these ordinances in recent years? What are we seeing out there? I know Kansas City did one back in the early 1990s, I think.
Yeah, so that was on the Missouri side. On the Kansas side, outside of the metro, you have Lawrence and Manhattan. And in the metro, you have Roland Park about 4 years ago, and then a unified government of Wyandotte County earlier this summer.
You know, my sense, Brett, is that when Roland Park adopted this ordinance, the city had a raucous fight over this thing. I get the sense now that maybe the intensity of this issue is dying down a little bit. Am I seeing that correctly?
I think so. I mean, I think we've come a long way in the last 4 years on LGBT rights. And I think it's becoming more... I think people are becoming more okay with it. And they're seeing, you know, in Roland Park 4 years ago, there was the fight. And since then, there hasn't been this backlash. The city hasn't burned down.
The world's still spinning.
Yes. And it's just allowed those citizens to have that protection and the kind of the weight off their shoulders of worrying about being discriminated against.
Okay, now for a different view of all this, joining us now on the phone from Washington, D.C. is Eric Tietzel. He's president of the Family Policy Alliance of Kansas. Eric, thanks for taking some time. I appreciate it.
Hi, Steve. Thanks. And I'm sorry I couldn't be there with you, but thank you for letting me call in.
Well, your organization says there's no need for non-discrimination ordinances for members of the LGBTQ community. I'm wondering why.
That's exactly right. Three basic reasons why. The first is there's no evidence of discrimination against members of the LGBT community in our community. I have been to the testimonies in Mission and Prairie Village. I've looked back at the testimonies from other cities that passed these, and I heard testimony from council members from those cities, all of whom admitted that there was no evidence of discrimination before they passed their ordinances, and there's been no enforcement since they passed them. In fact, all of the anecdotes that we heard from proponents of these suggested that these communities are entirely welcoming of their citizens who identify as LGBT. The second reason is that they're tremendously expensive. The city of Prairie Village has already spent something like $10,000, and they haven't even finalized the language yet. That doesn't include the cost of monitoring and enforcement. And of course, it doesn't include the potential cost of litigation should these things end up in court. The state of Colorado, for example, incurred over $125,000 in in-house legal expenses alone when they enforced their sexual orientation and gender identity non-discrimination ordinance against the baker, Jack Phillips. I think taxpayers need to ask if it's necessary to put that kind of money on the line for an unnecessary law. And the third reason, and probably the most important, is that these laws send a really terrible message to members of the community. They say that there are certain people, people of faith, people who don't share a particular view of human sexuality who aren't welcome here. And that's not what Kansas is. Those aren't Kansas values.
Now, there's this term, sincerely held religious beliefs, that gets kicked around here a lot because it's used frequently, including in the majority opinion of a Colorado baker who refused to create a wedding cake for a gay couple. So I'm wondering if that same couple had asked for a birthday cake for just one member of the couple, would it have been an issue? And I'm wondering why or why not?
It would not have been. And in fact, Jack Phillips and Baronelle Stutzman and Aaron and Melissa Klein and Elaine Huguenin, and I could go on and on and on with examples of everyday people whose lives were destroyed when they were prosecuted simply for trying to work out of their belief system. And all of them happily served and were friends with LGBT customers. This has nothing to do with any kind of personal animus towards a person merely because of their sexual orientation.
But I can't help but point out that, you know, the Westboro Baptist Church might have referred to sincerely held beliefs to justify what they did.
I'm glad you mentioned that. The Westboro Baptists are despicable, and there's no faith in them. Anyone who's ever picked up a Bible or knows anything about Jesus knows that what they do is the opposite of him and his values. And we should all join together in repudiating those hateful bigots. The point is that a sincerely held religious belief is not a blank check to do anything you want. It's a term that has real legal meaning. You have to be able to show that there's a history of this belief, that there are other people who share that belief. So something like the Christian belief in marriage between a man and a woman, for example, goes back 6,000 years, and literally billions of people on the planet share that view. So we can agree that that's a sincerely held religious belief.
Well, the Supreme Court ruling in the wedding cake case was very narrow, and it left the door open to future challenges. You know, if a gay couple is ultimately refused service, do you think sincerely held beliefs can stand any legal test that's thrown against them?
No, the truth is they can't. The Supreme Court has established a model through which they consider claims under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And there are situations where the state says, even though you have a sincerely held religious belief, we're gonna infringe upon it because the state has a compelling interest in doing so. I believe that the Supreme Court will eventually find that there is no compelling government interest in saying to people who are just trying to live out their faith at work that they should have to be compelled to violate their conscience to use their speech for something that, right, that they don't agree with.
Okay, that's Eric Tietzel. He's president of the Family Policy Alliance of Kansas. Eric, appreciate you taking some time today.
Thanks again, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Let me go back into the studio here with Brett Hodel, again, chair of the Metro KC chapter of Equality Kansas, and Solly Flora, who's a counselor, a council member for the city of Mission, which has passed protections in that community. You know, Brett, you just heard Eric say there's no evidence that LGBTQ people are discriminated against. What about that?
I think that's one of the first things a lot of folks ask when these ordinances come up is, where is the evidence that there is an issue? And the fact is, discrimination isn't against the law. If somebody is fired for being gay, or kicked out of their apartment for being gay, there isn't somewhere they can report that if they don't want to go public. They mm-hmm. can't report it to an agency. They can't report it to the federal government.
And so, as a result, there's no stats that show these folks are being discriminated against.
Exactly. All you have really is either anecdotal evidence or really high-level stats from other cities and states that do actually have these protections. And so it's really hard to provide that evidence. But I think you've seen in some of these city council meetings where citizens have come forward and talked about issues that they've faced, whether it was discrimination, not feeling safe in their own communities, not feeling safe coming out at work. And so I take issue with the idea that there's no evidence of this. I think there's evidence across the country that discrimination yeah. exists.
Solly, I'm wondering what was happening in Mission prior to the time that you guys passed these protections. Were you getting complaints from LGBTQ folks saying we've got a problem?
Yeah, so just one quick point of clarification. We have not passed an ordinance yet. We're in the process. It went through the first stages, but we're still looking at exact language, and we'll be having a vote on that. But similar to what Brett said, you know, there isn't any system to take an account of these complaints before, exactly because there hasn't been a protection. So, for example, if you were discriminated on the basis of your race, there are avenues for you to pursue that. We have data on that. But there isn't that because there aren't LGBT protections in our state.
Anecdotally, have you heard stories?
Anecdotally, you know, we had several citizens who came to speak at our public hearing. And one point that Brett alluded to is that you have people who still have to hide their complete self, you know, in their employment, and have to be careful, feel like they have to be careful about what they say about their personal life, about their families, about the people that they love, because they are worried about the repercussions, knowing that there are currently no protections for them.
How big of an issue is this in Johnson County, just writ large right now? I couldn't help but notice that, I think I mentioned in the intro, that Overland Park has taken at least one small step towards beginning a conversation about this. How big of an issue do we have in Johnson County?
I think the issue is that when there is a gap in the law and people don't feel safe, there is a large population of LGBTQ individuals and their families in Johnson County. And this gap does create somewhat of a second, I don't want to say second class, but the when you don't feel like you can put up a picture of your spouse at your desk for fear of what your coworker is going to think, or
right.
your manager,
right?
That creates a very uninviting environment for these individuals. So, it is an issue everywhere that these protections don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Sally.
Yeah, and I was just going to add, you do see a real impact. So, in national surveys that have taken a look at people who feel they have been discriminated against, you will see a lot of complaints of discrimination, you know, housing discrimination, employment mm-hmm. discrimination. And you also see the harm that just discrimination writ large is doing to the LGBT community. So, for example, the youth suicide rate in the LGBT community is far higher than you see in other populations. You know, poverty and homelessness, same thing. And it's because there are still a lot of people in our society who unfortunately aren't welcoming and loving to this population.
You know, Solly, when you consider a law in Mission, don't these ordinances typically have exclusions for specific religious organizations that might ease concerns in some ways?
Yeah, like I said, we're still in the midst of drafting the specifics of ours. But if you look, for example, at the Roland Park ordinance, you will see that religious institutions, there is a carve out for that. And that mirrors, you know, I think a lot of the provisions of that ordinance mirror.
Explain what that does, just so everyone's on the
same
page.
Sure. So a church, for example, would be carved out. And
for what reason?
Because of some of those concerns about religious freedom, and because we recognize the distinction between the public sphere and religious life. So we have, you know, laws of general applicability when you're acting in the public sphere. So, for example, if you're operating a store and, you know, interracial marriage is against your sincerely held religious beliefs, we as a society have determined that that is not an acceptable basis to discriminate when you're operating, say, a gas station?
I've got 20 seconds, Brett.
I think when we're talking about the religious carve out, we aren't looking. Our communities aren't looking to go into a church and say you have to start marrying same-sex couples.
Mm-hmm.
You do not have to incorporate, you know, something that's against your religious beliefs into your religious practice. We're saying that if you're going to operate in the public sphere, you should be required to offer your services or products or whatnot to everybody equally.
Okay, that's the voice of Brett Hodel, again, chair of the Metro KC chapter of Equality Kansas. We were also we're joined by Sally Flora. She's a city council member for the City of Mission. Thank you both for a good conversation. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Well, look who just came in the door to talk about cool stuff to do on the weekend. It's Brian McTavish and the Weekend To-Do List. Welcome back.
Oh, hey.
How are you?
So feeling perhaps a trifle ill at ease heading into the weekend?
Given what atmospheric tune is coursing through my head, I guess I am.
It's the tip-off for sure, but let's proceed. Indeed, haunted houses, well, they've been open for a while now.
Yes, they have.
But this is the final weekend before.
They're a big deal in this town. Have been for a long time. Every big town have a bunch of these things?
Some do, some don't. But yes, we're a movie town / haunted house town. That's Kansas City.
Yes.
I'm sure we're more than that.
Yeah.
Anyway, this weekend, you can go to The Beast, The Edge of Hell, and Macabre Cinema. That's the trio of haunted houses down there along 12th and 13th Street in Kansas City's...
I bet they're scary.
West Bottoms. Oh, no. Oh, yes, they're
yes,
scary.
Yes, they are.
Oh, my gosh, they're scary.
Luke Martin's, our producer, shaking his head. They're not scary?
Oh, come on.
I'd be scared.
He's a young buck. He thinks he's not scared.
One of my sons went in one of those places once. He was a little too young for it, and I think it...
Did he come out?
Yeah, well, barely. Yeah, I think it affected him for a while.
Well,
yeah.
Let's
maybe it still does.
Oh, yeah. Trust me.
Yeah.
He's affected. Well, let's just very, very briefly but meaningfully explore The Beast. You'll get lost in The Beast because they have this thing called an open format, which means good luck ever finding your way out.
Yes.
The Edge of Hell... you'll literally descend from heaven to Hades. I think they have this massive slide.
It costs money to go in these things.
$27.
Ouch.
Per house. But discounts are available, Steve.
Oh, are they for senior citizens?
No, if you go to two or three at a time.
Oh, I see.
But you have to be 13 years or older. Let's not forget Macabre.
At least 13.
How about, but also Macabre Cinema, that's lots of scary scenes recreated from classic horror films.
If you die before you finish, you get a discount, I'm told.
I think it's free.
Yeah. No, in that case, it's free. You get your money back.
They'll pick up the funeral expenses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of Satan's influence, I think we're listening to it.
I would call it pseudo-Satan's influence because what you have here is a band called Ghost, the perfect weekend before Halloween band.
Yes.
In a nutshell, outlandish Swedish hard rockers with ironic satanic leanings. How's that?
Yeah.
8 o'clock Saturday night. Where else but Arvus Bank Theater at the Midland. They've won a Grammy Award for Best Metal Band for something or another over the years. But the over-the-top Gala of Doom at 8 o'clock Saturday night at the Midland is fronted by Tobias Forge, who goes by the stage name of Cardinal Copia, and whose facial features are obscured by a prosthetic mask. At least, I think it's a mask.
Ouch.
Anyway, they do songs like this. We've been listening to Rats. Isn't that sweet? And they do a song called Ash, and they do a song called It's a Sin. Well, of course it is, Ghost.
Of course it is.
Of course it is. All I can say is somewhere, original shock rocker Alice Cooper is saying, you're welcome.
Yeah, there you go. Be sure to see Brian's 6 Halloweeny things to do in Kansas City this weekend. You'll find it at kcur.org. Like this song. Always like this song.
Yeah, you got to think of a reason to play this whenever possible.
Absolutely.
And here's the semi-perfect reason to play it. It's these are the zombies from long ago and far away, but it's present weekend time. It's a zombie attack.
Mm.
Now, get this.
All of us are under attack by zombies?
At all times.
Yes.
But only on Halloween is it celebrated.
Oh.
Or especially
dreaded.
We're going
to celebrate this attack.
Okay. Let's do this. It's a zombie attack. Oh, it's the time of the season in which you can go and, via laser tag, pick off members of the shambling living dead. Now, this happens from 7 to 11 Friday and Saturday
nights. Like real zombies, right?
If you say so.
Yes.
Anyway, amusingly enough, the zombie attack takes place at Paradise Park, which is a family fun and adventure center in Lee's Summit. So that's either too good or too bad, but it's something crazy. It's some kind of a family attraction in which you go down the hayride paths and you shoot up undead members as fast and as best as you can. And how can you do this? Because zombies are stupid. They just moan and groan and kind of lumber in the wrong direction.
So if you want to survive a zombie apocalypse, this is your chance.
Paradise Park, baby, all the way. Zombie attack Friday and Saturday night.
Frankenstein was the first in line, and the Wolfman came up next. Dracula was a-doing his stuff, a-breathing down my the hunchback, better get out of his way. Faith, faith, five, five, full, full vomit was a monster's holiday.
What do we got here?
Oh, we got it all. Okay, so let's say you don't want to lose your mind or get too spooked. Families who just want to have a nice and easy trick-or-treat experience, go to Historical Hauntings at Shawneetown 1929. You get family-style trick-or-treating.
There's definitely a theme to this weekend to-do list, isn't there?
It's crept
very
up.
Clear-cut.
What, ready? It's crept up on us.
Yeah.
Boo. Oh, that was a pretty good... Anyway, you get the trick-or-treats, you get the hayrides, you get like four or five different all-ages costume contests. 6 to 8:30, just a 2.5-hour deal Saturday night at Shawneetown 1929.
And finally today, who do we have here?
Okay, that's actually fitting with our Halloween theme. That tune is actually called Rockula, and it's by Los Straitjackets. Who were Los Straitjackets?
You took the question out of my mouth.
I grabbed it, and I'm going to run with it. Okay, they're surf rockers extraordinaire. No kidding. I've seen them. They're fantastic. They wear Mexican wrestling masks, which makes it perfect for Halloween. They've already got their Halloween masks
on. Everybody's got a gimmick.
Everybody needs a gimmick. I saw these guys open for veteran pure popster Niccolo not that long ago. They were his... They opened, but they were his backing band. On their own, they fill dance floors. It's all instrumental guitar action like 1960s legends like The Ventures and Dick Dale. They have a bag of familiar riffs, Steve, that is bottomless, and they will play the theme from the Batman TV show from the 1960s, and they will play it better than you have ever heard it before.
That's Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, the film critics are back. They have a lineup of documentary and indie movies you can catch at area theaters this weekend. You'll want to hear that. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.